You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to episode 176 of Atheistically Speaking. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Well, we've got a lot more debate for you here. So I'm just going to get right into it because it's already going to be long enough as it is. So I appreciate you listening and supporting me at patreon.com/atheist. And that's it for me. I'll turn you over to me. Well, the debate me. It's two different me's. Okay, sorry. Maybe a quick one for Rob here. Let me see if this works when I select it. Can you guys see that?
I can't.
Okay, if it didn't pop up, I will go ahead and read it. God and this is from Charlie Baker. God interfering with our free will, and he's quoting Exodus, when the Lord hardens Pharaoh's heart, and he would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said to Moses. So what would your response to that be, Rob, where it looks like in the Bible, and I know, again, we were more talking about theism and not Christianity, but given that you subscribe and you mentioned the Bible and that you subscribe to Christianity, what would you say to that quote, if you don't mind?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And what's important is that particular issue in Exodus 9 backs up a little bit further, as we see God giving Pharaoh time and time again chances to turn the people over. And, you know, after each plague, you know, was another question posed and so on. And this is actually brought up in Romans 9 as well. This is God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But I think, again, if we, again, and I do adopt this idea of Molinism, that based on all of the things that God knew Pharaoh would do, that he hardened his heart based on what Pharaoh had done. So I think it's both based on how God had ordered the world, but it's also based on what Pharaoh did and would have continued to do.
I think you probably described it by context a little bit, but I was really trying hard not to interrupt you guys' flow because it was really good. But I did want to wonder for people, definitely not me, but you know, for other people, if you could define Molinism. You know, I mean, I know I could do it, but no, could you define for maybe the people who aren't as experienced in philosophy of religion as you two clearly are, define Molinism? And also, if someone could give a good quick definition of skeptical theism, just in case, to clarify for people trying to follow along.
Yeah, I'll pick up on Molinism and then I'll let Justin do skeptical theism. So Molinism was this idea that was developed by Louis Molina, as a 16th century Jesuit priest. And what happened, he's a counter-reformer, right? So he was trying to understand these two streams that we see in the Bible of free will and God's sovereignty. So he posited that there is a third type of knowledge that God has, and it's called middle because it falls logically between God's free knowledge and natural knowledge, and it's before the divine decree, which states that God knows what we would do, not could or will, but knows what we would do in any set of circumstances. And based on that, he can order the world, maintaining our free will and still getting his will done. So that's a snapshot of it. And there's actually an article on the website that I just wrote called A Brief Sketch of Molinism. So if anyone wants to familiarize themselves.
That's apologetics105.com, right?
That's right. Yep.
Perfect. Okay. Well, skeptical theism was developed primarily as a response to Rowe's argument, Rowe's evidential argument from evil. And skeptical theism, I should say that the argument within the argument there is an attempt to move from the claim that there are many instances of suffering which appear to be gratuitous, which appear to be pointless, to the claim that therefore at least one of them is pointless. Right, so that seems like a really intuitive kind of move, but the skeptical theist comes along and says, look, compared to God, our knowledge and our understanding of the causal relations of different events is so minimal that we are not even entitled to that kind of inference. And so the skeptical theist pulls the rug out from under the Roe-style argument and says, look, we can't even say that. The problem is that, at least within the last 10 years or so, there's been a swath of papers about skeptical theism highlighting some of the things that it also entails, which are not particularly welcome on the theistic view.
So do you accept that as a good definition, Rob?
Yeah, I think that's fine. Because, I think that's pretty basic. I'll go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you, is that something you subscribe to? Because I'm actually getting in the questions, I'm getting some people who think you do and some people who don't. And I know multiple times Justin said, well, if you subscribe to skeptical theism, then, you know, most of this goes away, or maybe the particular point he was talking about. Is that something you subscribe to? And if not, why don't you?
No, I don't subscribe to it as saying this is the ground I'm sticking my flag into. And the reason why is because I'm not familiar with it enough to articulate it to a point where I can defend it adamantly. If we're just talking about skeptical theism with, say, another Christian or something, the reason why I used it in my opening is because I think it's a good potential option. And I don't see anything contradictory about it on its face. But no, it's not something that I and would define myself as in a proper sense.
So Justin, if he had, let's say, said, well, I'm a skeptical theist, therefore, you know, et cetera, how would you have defended your claims today against that?
Well, at least if we're talking about Roe's argument, Roe's original formulation of the argument, skeptical theism, I would argue, does do away with Roe's argument. But it doesn't come out of that unscathed. There are problems that skeptical theism, at least the kind which would be able to dispense with Roe's argument, there are problems with that kind of skeptical theism. One of them being that it would seem to put people in a kind of moral paralysis. So if we are unable to place probabilities on the motivations of God in the relation to the states of affairs in the world, then, for example, if I'm walking around in a park and there's a little girl drowning in a pond, I could easily save her. But then I have to ask the question, well, who am I to say that this is not for some greater good? Who am I to intervene on God's ultimate plan? Maybe this death is necessary for some suffering 500 years in the future. So this kind of extreme skepticism is not without its problems. Hmm.
So I'm going to get to more questions submitted, definitely, but just again, because of that imbalance, I'd like to ask Justin a question, and it has to do with something Rob said. Now, Rob, as one of his arguments, and Rob, if I get this wrong, let me know. He had mentioned that atheists will say, well, why couldn't God's all powerful? Why couldn't he have come up with a better system, a better way of creating us that isn't so full of suffering, et cetera, et cetera? And I believe Rob's main response was, well, can you propose one? I mean, he's never heard of an atheist who can give an alternate explanation, an alternate kind of schematic of how a process that would have led to us could come about. Do you see that as a valid challenge? I mean, I know if we were talking scientifically, I think we would be required to provide some sort of plausible alternative when you're talking about models of the universe or anything like that. It's not like you can just say, well, something, you know, like you usually have to define something. So do you see that as a valid criticism?
Well, if I'm remembering correctly, it was in the context of a discussion about the possible justifying reasons for free will, right? And I was saying that he was saying that, look, if you want to say that it's possible to have free will and to be guarantee that there will be no evil or no sin or whatever, then that's a problem. And so presumably he's kind of referring to this idea of Alvin Plantinga put together this free will defense, which is a response to the logical problem of evil, which attempts to say that there is a logical contradiction. It's a much stronger claim than I was making tonight. And Plantinga was saying, look, here's a scenario where it's possible to have, or here's a scenario that shows that it's impossible for God to preserve libertarian free will, and while at the same time also completely preventing any evil, right? So I believe his comment was in response to something like that. What I was suggesting is free will be damned. If God doesn't have the kind of libertarian free will in the sense of morally significant free will where he can legitimately choose between two options because it's impossible for God to choose evil, if that's a perfectly fine scenario, why can't God just multiply that? Why can't he give us all perfect natures and have us be, you know, acting perfectly as a result? That's, of course, not an impingement on free will. It's just showing that free will is irrelevant. Because if God's lacking free will is not a bad thing, then why is it bad for us to lack it?
Rob, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that if you want.
Sure, and that's because God doesn't create maximally great beings. He creates human beings. So I would argue that that's just like saying we need to create more gods. And I get what you're saying as far as why, if God has this morally perfect nature, but we still say that he has free will to choose, why is that the case? And why can't he duplicate that into humanity? My response still is because he's not creating more gods. He's not creating people with like natures, with those maximally great attributes.
But why isn't he? I that was one area of the exchange that I'm not sure I got. I'm not sure I understood your argument, Rob, because Justin was asking essentially why create these, you know, kind of pathetic humans? why create us when he could just create other beings like him that apparently have fulfillment and whatever extent you guys agreed, if God has free will, and definitely God is good. I think you can both agree that by definition, I mean, God is a good being. So why can't he just create more little gods instead of us?
Well, if he created more little gods, that would mean that he is no longer the maximally great being. That would be a shared, that'd be more like a Mormonistic type theology. So I guess I just don't see how that – I don't think that would be logically possible to do that, because then he would no longer be maximally great. And I'll be honest, I've actually never had that question posed to me before, so I would definitely like to look at it more. But that would be my initial reaction. So I think it's a good question. I think it's a question that deserves probably a better answer than what I gave. But I think that would be my first thing, is that maximally great being category would no longer be solely owned. And it sounds a lot like a Mormonistic type theology to me.
Do you care to respond to that, Justin? Or
I would like to, but I don't know that it's appropriate. Maybe we should go to more questions.
Okay, we'll go to more questions. let me ask one. I think this has come up a lot of different listeners. So let me go ahead and select that, even though I know it's not doing you too much good. I think you can't see it, but maybe the viewers can see it. Jeff Louder is watching. So thanks, Jeff. Very appreciated.
Hey, Jeff.
much appreciated. And he submitted a lot of incredibly thoughtful questions, but he says human freedom at best explains so-called moral evils. It doesn't explain so-called natural evils like floods, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, et cetera. So, Rob, what would your response to that be?
That natural laws have to work in natural ways for us to understand them in a meaningful sense. If laws were sort of a hodgepodge put together of things work sometimes, things don't work other times, then it would be extremely difficult for us to understand the reality of natural disasters, like you mentioned. The other thing, too, is that human beings are not without at fault for what we see in the natural world. Like, for instance, we have a significant intelligence about how things take place, weather patterns and the like. And even take a terrible, terrible tragedy like Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Like, we knew that the walls they built were only Category 3. We knew Category 5 storms exist, yet people still lived there, and they knew it was a frequented zone. So I think a combination of natural laws having to work in natural ways, as well as a certain level of responsibility for humanity, would go a long way to answering that.
But surely that only explains for the last, 100 years? Or, I mean, how long have we had the requisite knowledge to make that our fault? And as far as I know, I mean, the science of the earth hasn't changed a whole lot. It may have been worse at some times, may have been a little better, but natural disasters have to have been occurring long before we knew how to do anything about it, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. And that's why I said that the second part's more of a peripheral additive than what natural law is having to work consistently. I think that's the primary answer.
And so I guess that entails, and I want to make sure I get this right, that whatever laws are required for free will, those you're saying those entail other evils like, or I don't know if that evils is the right word, but other suffering like earthquakes and floods, like in order for them to be consistent, those things need to happen. Is that right?
Yeah, I think if we and let's look at the Christian worldview for a moment and look at something like the fall of humanity. So these things taking place after the fall, and we could probably talk about different Christians who definitely disagree on that about how the fall exactly works. But yeah, I think if we're consistent and we say, for instance, you have typhoons or earthquakes or tornadoes or fires or whatever, that would one be a result of the fall, and two, also be restricted to something like the natural evils always having to work on a consistent basis. So that would entail part of my response, I guess.
Forgive me for grilling you one more time on this, because I just thought of something else, and I can't help it. I got to ask this.
You better grill me next.
I do have a good one for you, Justin. Don't worry. but assume it's not unlikely. It seems to me not unreasonable to assume that one day, 100, 200 years, I don't know what, we will have the technology and ability to avoid virtually every natural disaster. Do you have any explanation for why God would then have wanted to sort of punish people in primitive times more so than in that time? I mean, in that time, most of these instances of suffering would be eliminated and life would be just way better. I mean, what did the people born 1,000 years ago do so wrong to have that much more suffering inflicted on them?
Yeah, two things. I don't really mind you grilling me, because when Justin and I had our first debate, he received way, and this was in my town, so he received far more grilling than I did.
This is justified suffering.
So I think one big mistake a lot of Christians make is they say like floods and natural disasters are God's punishment on people. And I guess I just don't see that to be the case, at least biblically speaking. I think it's a case of natural law taking place. And we can talk about why that's the case or why God might have a reason. But we could always talk about the skeptical theistic part, which says, we may not know why this particular natural disaster took place, but there's nothing logically incoherent by saying God doesn't have a reason for it. But people just saying it's just God's punishment, it's God, saying these people are terrible. I don't know. I've never agreed with that. I think
want to clarify. I'm not saying it's his punishment, but I am saying that would it not be considered unjust of a perfect being to inflict so much more suffering that, I mean, by your view is necessary in some way, on a people who lived 1,000 years ago versus a people who live later who, I mean, just any given person born at that time, did they do anything more wrong? I mean, does that not strike you as unjust? I'm not saying he's punishing per se, but the distribution of this so natural suffering, as it were, isn't that a bit unjust?
Well, I guess you mentioned in the beginning that in a couple hundred years, we may have a way to route pretty much every single natural disaster. And I would love to hear why that's the case. I think that'd be awesome. I don't think it's true, but no, I don't.
Do you think that's impossible? I mean, just look at the casualties that happen in this country, for example, when there's a flood, a hurricane. They're still bad, of course, but they're so much better than in countries that are a little bit in areas that are a little bit more behind in technology and development. Is it unreasonable to assume that that might carry forward to the point where it'd be greatly reduced? Maybe it won't be eliminated, but there could be a time when most of the planet doesn't really even suffer from natural disasters.
I think it could be better, and that sort of ties into the second part of what I was saying, which is why I think we as humans should have more responsibility to do things like fix living conditions in third world countries for people. So that may very well be a part of it, saying these things are continually happening. We need to build up other countries who are not our own, who are not in a third world status. So yeah, I don't see it as punishment, and I don't see that it's, you said, unjust to the people who were 1,000 years prior. And the other thing, too, is if we do understand God to be the author of life, then we don't really have any guarantee to live X amount of years anyhow. So I think it's a fun topic. I think it's interesting. And I would definitely like to talk more, not now, but about the the conditions in a couple hundred years that would limit natural disasters. I think that'd be interesting.
Well, I have a bigger question for you, Justin, but I want to point that last part towards you. I don't think that came up necessarily in your guys' exchange. What do you think about what he just said, what Rob just said, that we don't necessarily have, what was the words, that we don't really have like the right to a certain, sorry, Rob, can you repeat what you said on that?
It is, if we were,
we're not the authors of life, that part.
Right. Yeah. So if we understand God to be the author of life, we don't necessarily have any right to say, this is when we need to, this is where we need to live. We're not guaranteed 80 years. So if, and again, Christian worldview, we understand that there's something far better than this life, after our human bodies pass. So
what would be your response to that, Justin?
To the God's the author of life, and therefore,
yeah, I mean, I guess a response to your arguments of about suffering, if he were to say, well, God's the author of life and he has the right to sort of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's probably, I mean, obviously the author of life premise there is going to be entailed by both theism and specific forms of theism like Christianity. And it might be that Christianity also entails the additional claim that therefore, you know, he has the right to take, you know, essentially the Bill Cosby theodicy where, you know, I brought you in this world, I can take you out. It might be that
we need to find a new name for that now.
I know. but what I would say about that is I don't think that you could reach that conclusion from that premise. And I would say that the conclusion that therefore that God can take your life away without any care, I don't think that that's entailed by the claim that he's the author of life. And so I think that it would be false on theism, but maybe that's something entailed specially to Christian theism. But Christian theism is not something I take terribly seriously at this point. So I don't think that that would apply to theism generally, but maybe it's a specific feature of Christian theism.
Okay, well, I've referenced it. I'm going to go ahead and start on what I think is my best question for you, Justin. I hope. We'll see. One of the more interesting exchanges I think you guys had was when you were talking about, I believe Rob asked Justin about why suffering would be necessarily bad under naturalism. And Justin, your response was interesting. I thought that was a good question, but your response, you sidestepped it, but I think legitimately by saying you're not defending naturalism. The proposition up for debate is more, is suffering evidence against God, assuming theism? You know, assuming, right, is that a proper characterization roughly of what you said?
Right. So essentially my point was there that on naturalism, it may or may not be that moral realism of some sort is true, right? Naturalism doesn't guarantee that. But on theism, I would take it as relatively uncontroversial that theism does entail that a robust kind of moral realism is true. So when you compare those two hypotheses, one entailing the moral issue and one not, then, you know, at least looking at it that way, then these problems with morally bad states of affairs like suffering, that theism is going to have a weaker explanatory power there. His question was about, you know, whether or not on, you know, these things are really bad on naturalism. But I mean, again, the argument doesn't require that they be bad.
Right. That's the part I wanted to highlight. And I thought it was interesting. And then I thought it's almost as though you were handing over the reins to theism as to whether or not suffering is bad, because I do think it is pretty vital one way or the other to your argument, Justin, to say that suffering is something bad. I mean, it's not
– Well, it's bad in the sense that, like, yeah, I'm going to use negative value terms to describe what happens when I stub my toe, like, quite clearly.
We're talking about suffering for a reason, right? I mean, the debate is suffering, but not – the debate is not, you know, golf. Is it evidence against God? The debate is not, you know, it's specifically, it's not something, right? I mean, and I thought it was interesting that you were saying that all that matters is that it's bad under theism, which I think is I think it's true because you're saying it's, you're almost saying it's inconsistent. You're pointing out an inconsistency logically, you know, or.
No, I don't want to do that. So maybe it's possible, of course, that I misspoke. So I don't want to say that suffering entails the falsity of theism.
Sure.
All I want to say is that you have this observation, this empirical fact of suffering, right? That's not up for debate. The empirical fact is that there's a widespread there's a lot of suffering going on, right? And so the question is whether or not, you know, what the implication of that is on theism and what the implication of that is on a plausible atheistic hypothesis. On theism, it's entailed, or at least I would think that it's plausibly entailed, that suffering is a bad thing, that there's an extra thing being added to the mere empirical fact that there's suffering going on. But it's that suffering is not only happening, but it's bad. And that has a special relevance to a theistic hypothesis, which says that God is, among other things, admittedly, interested also in the well-being of his conscious creatures. And that's why I'm saying that's why it's especially a problem for theism, because of that interesting relationship. On indifference, there is nobody out to protect us, right? There is nobody interested in our well-being except for us. And so that's the incongruity going on there, I guess.
Right, I see what you're saying, but I'm glad I get a chance to grill you a bit, because apologies if I'm missing something, but I think the interesting point that I'm trying to illustrate here is that you did say that it's not entirely relevant on naturalism or on indifference to establish that suffering is necessarily bad. I think you did grant that. I hope you granted that it's necessary to your arguments to have a belief that suffering is bad. Otherwise, why are you even asking the question?
Let me think about this. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, like, if I were just a complete nihilist and I thought that value terms were just like, if I was like the most extreme nihilist ever and I thought that value terms were just meaningless, then I could still raise this argument, because it would still be the case that we're talking about the empirical fact of suffering, not the value of suffering. So the empirical fact.
And you're talking about relative to theism, right? I mean, you're talking about.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, so the question I want to bring to you now is, could not one therefore say, well, if we're using sort of the value judgments of theism here, and we're using, to be consistent, we're going with that. Could you not just say, under theism, sure, suffering is bad, but free will is better than that? And you would be kind of forced. Well, yeah, but you're sort of forced to accept that if you're only going with theism's definition of what's right and wrong. I mean, isn't that sort of a way out of your arguments?
Well, yeah. So the free will, the appeal to free will, would be an attempt to say that, like, you know, that this goes to some degree to explaining the suffering, right? Because remember, my argument was an explanatory argument. Exploring the explanatory power of theism relative to indifference, right? It's been done quite a few times before where someone would appeal to free will to explain some kind of suffering. But as your questioner Jeff Lauder already brought to the table, that really only applies to moral suffering. And usually philosophers want to distinguish moral suffering from natural suffering. Moral suffering being the suffering that is in some way the fault of a moral agent, and natural suffering being suffering which is the fault of, or maybe not the fault of, the is the result of the laws and the way that the universe is set up. So free will would be relevant to one half of that equation.
Do you want to respond to that, Rob?
Well, yeah, the reason why I asked the question, and I know Justin's not defending naturalism, but I thought it was important to bring out, because I don't think, if he's saying we see suffering in the world, and then theism gives a poor explanation to why that's the case. I want to know, why do you think suffering is objectively bad? Like, why, where is it grounded in? To me, the most consistent position is nihilism, because you're saying ethics and morals are illusory. But if that's the case, then why argue that there's suffering in the world objectively and that theism is a poor explanation for it? That's why I asked the question. I just think, I don't think a naturalist or an atheist can ground objective moral values and duties, which do pertain very heavily to suffering.
Sure. So, there's two things to address there. There's one that naturalists or atheists would be incapable of grounding facts about the values of suffering, and that's an interesting question. And there's a variety of answers out there, obviously, and some of them being that it's not even necessary to ground them. That in the sense that you could just say that these are just facts that exist out there. They don't get further explained. They're just brute in the universe, right? That's like one possible way. There's other ways, of course. I'm not necessarily subscribing to that. But and then there's the question of whether or not one can run this argument, this comparative explanatory argument, by appealing to the empirical fact of suffering. The empirical fact of suffering is something we both agree on. That's the agreed upon observation here. The question is whether or not that observation fits better on naturalism or on indifference or on theism. On theism, there is something that does not exist on naturalism, mainly a God who cares about suffering, right? So that's a huge difference. On theism, you'd expect that it wouldn't just be a complete indifferent free-for-all about the suffering. On theism, you'd expect certain intervening behaviors, perhaps, from morally perfect beings. So it's less expected on theism. At the very least, it's less expected.
Yeah, I guess I just don't see, because you said we both observe suffering in the world, so we both observe things that take place that would institute suffering, but the question is, how do we ground it? How do we know that it's not illusory? You know, and you can say...
suffering isn't illusory.
But it may very well be if you're a nihilist, if it's not objective, like, why is it bad? So you mentioned an abstract object, like it could be grounded in something else, but abstract objects don't have any causal powers. They can't tell you to do something. So it would be insufficient to grounding a duty. But you didn't say you held to that view, so that's a possibility. But I think that view, just by the fact that abstract objects aren't causal, we can't account for duties, which are objective. So,
sure. I'll address both these points. As to the issue about abstract objects, I mean, nothing about the things that I did say about that view entails that they need be causally relevant here. It is not those abstract objects which are doing the actions in the world. That's not what the view would say. Secondly. What was the point you made just before that about? I'm forgetting, but perhaps we can move on.
we can move on. We've talked about that quite a bit, and that was in our last debate as well. So,
okay. Well, I do. I have another question from me. I think it'll be hopefully the last one that no one asked, because I really want to know. I cannot think of a possible explanation. We talked a lot about hypothetical examples of suffering, and the Fawn argument was brought up, the Fawn scenario, I guess. And that's when, you know, a natural fire from like lightning burns down the forest or whatever, a fawn is caught in it and dies and suffers. I just want to put to you, Rob, you did seem to answer those things by saying there the ripple effect, there could be unknown goods that come of that sort of thing. That was roughly speaking your answer to that problem, right? I just want to clarify before I go on.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, I really cannot think of the difference. Given an all-powerful God, how in the world could there be more good that would come from the fawn burning to death and suffering than from, say, just instant death via a tree branch, crush the skull instantly. I mean, things like that. I mean, it might seem like a silly question, but I think it's important because we are dealing with an all-powerful being who supposedly would want to eliminate needless suffering, right? Like completely needless suffering that serves no purpose. What could possibly be the additional value that anyone could get from the fawn actually internally feeling pain versus just the same exact scenario? The fawn still dies in the same place even, yet it's killed in a less painful way.
Yeah, there's a couple things with Rowe's arguments that are interesting because he sets it up in almost a way where he sets up parameters so tight that he can't possibly fail. So he's saying, well, no one observed this happen. No one knows that this happened. So no one can say, hey, we got to do more to get these deer out of here to make to make sure that that when we when we have lightning storms, that we have little alarms on trees that get deer out of the forest quicker or whatever. He sets it up in a way where no one sees this event take place. So it's almost, I wouldn't say logically contradictory, but he's saying no one sees the event take place, but I'm going to tell you that it took place.
But it's not hard to imagine something at least very much like that, right? I mean, we're talking about thousands of years. We're not even talking about humans. We're talking about millions of years of potential suffering anywhere in the entire world. Surely examples like that happened, right?
Maybe. I think – oh, man. Hold on, because if you read his entire narrative about the deer, like a lot of the specific details, to me, is like, I guess it's possible. I'm not saying it's logically impossible or anything like that. But again, we go back to the part of, I can say we don't know why, but it's not logically impossible that there is a greater reason. And I agree, it's hard to think of a reason for moment one why that's the case. I think it's hard to think of a reason why let's say a child gets hit by a car and dies. Like, that's hard to think about as well as to why, but I think a possibility can be brought about. And if that's the case, then there's nothing logically contradictory about it.
Then I have to ask you, is there any observable instance of suffering in our world that could possibly shake your faith in God then? I mean, is there such a thing as suffering so bad that you would say, no, no good? I mean, it sounds like your answer could apply to any suffering. I mean, we could literally all be feeling as much pain as possible right now. Right. And it seems like your answer would still work. You'd just say, well, there's probably some good reason for that. Is there anything that would shake your faith on that?
Well, of course, there's with that, say everyone's feeling the most amount of suffering they could possibly feel. And what I'm saying is that there's nothing logically contradictory about it. So of course it could work in various circumstances, but if you're asking if there's something emotionally that could shake my faith, I mean, I don't know. I haven't experienced the full gamut of things emotionally, but is it possible? Of course it's possible. But I just don't know. I mean, I can't put myself in that situation. And I think the good question to ask is what should change my faith? What should make me not believe in God? And there could be a couple answers to that I would entertain that I think would if something came about. But yeah, you're right. There could be a maximal amount of suffering in the world. And I could still say, well, it's not logically contradictory to God's existence because of, X amount of reasons. So,
well, it's one thing to say that it's not logically impossible, but there are tons of things that aren't logically impossible. I mean, little space aliens could be manipulating me right now. It's not logically impossible, but it's unreasonable to believe that, I hope, about me. Do you guys believe that? Because it's definitely not true. I'm just telling you. Totally not true. I am not just a group of aliens in a skin suit. Definitely not. Anyway, do you see what I mean, though? There's a difference between logical impossibility and something that's reasonable to believe.
Yeah, that comes to the distinction between, I mean, you guys have been going back and forth here a little bit about the logical problem of evil, whether it is even a possible justifying reason, right? And of course, in the debate, I never defended the logical problem of evil. I've defended the inductive problem of evil, the evidential problem of evil, which says that not only is that almost certainly the fawn example, something to have occurred before, it's almost certainly to have occurred millions and millions of times before. And if not in that exact circumstance, then in other circumstances where you run out of food and you starve to death slowly as an animal over days, or you get eaten alive, or, and you die of infection over a long period of time. Like those instances of suffering are going to be the modus operandi of the natural world. It's just what happens. And I'm not saying that it's logically impossible for God to have, justifying reasons for those kinds of events. I've merely claimed that there are other hypotheses that make way more sense of these kinds of things.
Rob, do you care to respond to that, or do you want me to move on to another question?
Let's just move on. We can go back and forth on that all day, okay. I think.
Justin, I've got a question for you here. I know you should be excited. Sorry. I went back. So I'm highlighting it here. Mike McElroy asked, why should we expect God to intervene to prevent suffering? Why should our suffering have any kind of primacy in God's calculus?
Well, if we are assuming classical theism here, then at the very least, we have a God that is not only morally perfect, but is also interested in our well-being. He's interested in other things, of course, too. It's not as though well-being must always trump in all possible circumstances any other goods that God might want to bring about. But there's certainly a reason for him to, however strong, for him to intervene at times and prevent suffering that that is unjustified. And again, it might be the case that you can bring up a scenario where there is a reason where God would want to play hands off because there's some greater good being brought. But I'm sorry, at the end of the day, when we count up the billions and billions and billions of slow deaths in the natural world, it's just not plausible to me that every single one of them is positively related to some great good down the line. And right. So I think because of that, there's good reason to think that indifference much better explains these facts.
Did you want to respond, Rob?
Yeah, I guess one thing, I mean, if we're going to assume the Christian worldview here, then it kind of ties back to what I said in my opening, which was that the chief purpose in life on the Christian worldview, or even if you want to talk classical theism, I would, add to with Christianity, is that our main goal here is not to live a life of happiness without any suffering. I would argue that suffering and sacrifice are necessary parts of life, in that we are to spread the knowledge of God, not to live lives that are free of pain and the like. So if we understand that in a context of heaven is real and there are certain people who go to heaven based on criteria of like faith, then to me, suffering seems to dissipate and not really matter that much if there's something greater beyond this world.
This is a good opportunity to go to a Twitter question. Actually, most of these have been on the Google Hangouts Q&A, which is kind of a nice way to ask questions. But we also got some on Twitter hashtag. And at Russell Teapot asked two. I think I'll kind of pose both these questions because they're free. they're free will related. I can't. Someone with a really dirty Twitter name should ask something, so I'd have to say it. That's like too good of a question. I gotta say it. No. He asks, "Is there free will in heaven, and is there evil in heaven?" And tied to that also, because I know free will was a lot of Rob's explanation for some of these things. How do we determine that we actually have the kind of free will that Rob has described, as which is an explanation for some of the suffering?
The first question, is there free will in heaven? It probably won't surprise you that Christians disagree on this particular area. I do think that Christians have free will in heaven, and I think that's because we understand the depth and the turmoil that comes as a result of sin. So much like I don't think people can forfeit their salvation, I think that if we say, well, in heaven, that the eternal conscious torment of hell would serve as a reminder to people about what sin is like, and we will have such a knowledge at the throne of judgment in the Bible that we have a better idea of how terrible and destructive sin is. So I do think there's free will in heaven, and I don't think that's different or incompatible with saying there won't be evil in heaven either, based on the things that have taken place in humanity and what we would call the end times or the last of the last days. So, and the second piece, What was the second question?
Sure. It's well, you've answered a lot of the challenges Justin has brought up with free will might be a justification. So he's asking, how do you know that we actually have that free will that you're saying is a justification?
I would say it would be properly basic. It's something that we can sense, and based on that, unless someone submits a defeater for it, then I think it would be properly basic to understand that we do have a legitimate choice between A and not A. So based on that, I think it's fair to say that we have free will as being properly basic. And if someone would like to bring a defeater for that, then we can interact with that.
Do you have anything to say on that, Justin?
I do, but that would be just so many more.
Yeah.
I mean, those are all questions that deserve, entire books to themselves. So.
And what we can do, if it's easier, if you just want to direct your question towards Justin, he can answer it, and then we can just move on, and we don't have to have Cross if you don't want to, Justin or Thomas, it's fine.
Oh, well, we're almost coming to the end of the Q&A, I think. I mean, well, we could really go on all day with this, but...
we have 8 hours.
Yeah. I'm going to max out the Google Hangout of 8 hours, and then I think we can just start another one, and then we'll be good, right? All right. I hope... I'll be honest. I think, unfortunately, I've run out of good questions submitted for Justin. So I'm going to have to ask one more for Rob. And that's why I'm kind of trying to include both of you on these questions, because of the balance and stuff. But, yeah. Rob, you mentioned the fall at one point. And someone has asked, Mike actually again has asked, I'll go ahead and select that in case it does anyone any favors. Do you believe in a literal fall of a literal Adam and Eve in a literal garden? If so, why are you even talking about natural laws working consistently? If science based on consistent natural laws leads to the story of the Garden of Eden being false?
Yeah, I think that's taking in a presupposition that cataclysmic event like the fall couldn't change natural laws. So I'm not saying that they're consistent insofar as they can never change. What I'm saying is that if there was a perfect setup in the world, and then something were to happen where it would be fall, and that is the new, not even new, but that's what we see, that's the world we're in, and that's the consistency that we have now. I guess I don't see how that couldn't be something prior that happened that would change the set of events for us in humanity.
So you'd essentially be saying that if somehow there were scientists around back then, you know, the natural, if they were just going on what the natural laws are and observable laws, they would say there was a Garden of Eden, whereas now those have been changed by some event. So we say, scientists say there wasn't.
Well, no, I think what a lot of people have trouble with, and this gets into another in-house debate with Christians, is this idea of young earth, old earth, was there death before the fall, and so on. I look at the fall as more of a spiritual thing with sin natures and the like. And I sort of lean towards the position that there still was death, animal death and the like before what we would call the fall. I do think there's a literal Adam and Eve, and I think the fall that normally I reference is more of a spiritual, but if someone picked up a young earth view, let's say, I think they could probably argue that somewhat successfully, but I look at it as more of a spiritual event, more than a earth changing, life shattering, you know, laws are now upside down kind of event. So.
Okay. Well, I think I'll put it to you both. We do have plenty more questions, but as I referenced, they're mainly for Rob. So I want to just ask you guys, would you prefer to wrap up with closing statements now? Do you want to keep grilling Rob with some questions?
I think closing statements would be pretty fine. I don't want to make it, you know, a completely one-sided thing. And I think it's already been, just because the nature of the questions have already been.
Hey, I did my best to grill. That's it. I'm going back to that question I asked, Jess. I'm going to grill you some more on that. All right. Well, with that said, thank everyone. I just thank you guys so much for the questions you submitted. I know obviously I couldn't get to all of them, but I think I got to a good number of them and they were very good. So thanks. And with that, I would like to open up closing statements, and I will go toward Rob. I'll get my timer here just so that we don't go overboard. And Rob, you have 5 minutes, closing statements.
Oh, 5 minutes. All right. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for moderating, as well as Justin for participating again. I think what's interesting in the debate for me and things that I've learned is that we can express one particular view, and then as we get deeper and deeper, come into some unknowns where we don't particularly know the answer. And, you know, that's one thing I kind of like about dialoguing with Justin, is that he's not a person where everything that he says is true and he knows the answer to everything. And that's why I kind of like that type of interaction, because some of the questions he asked, I don't have a certain answer for it. And it's an answer that, you know, it's good to go and research and find. But I think on the whole, as we look at probabilistic versions of the problem of evil and different types, I still think that if we adopt a Christian worldview, it makes more sense than what we see on naturalism, if we were to carry that view out to its logical conclusion, insofar as what we see with suffering being pretty much illusory to the point where it's not really objective. My second point was on we looked at skeptical theism as well as various types of theodicies, where we would say that things like natural law, freedom, and moral responsibility supersedes that of suffering, and that it's necessary as a byproduct for that to exist. And the other part was skeptical theism, which we talked about in the context of Rowe's argument, which says, you know, we don't know why an all-loving, powerful, and knowing God would allow suffering to take place. So, and Justin admitted that if we were to adopt that view, that first argument falls away. And lastly, one thing we didn't get a chance to talk about a whole lot, but I think is interesting, and even if you don't subscribe to it, interesting to at least consider, is the idea of Molinism and how that plays in to our lives as a add-on to free will, if you will. That God has middle knowledge, and logically prior to the decree, he has ordered the world as such. That, you know, his will is still accomplished and our free will is still intact. And there's much more deeper parts to that that I'd like to express, but of course we're limited on time. The other thing I would like to encourage people listening to do is to actually have meaningful dialogue with people who you disagree with. I think, and I'm sure Justin would agree with me, is that a lot of times people prefer to respond in things and quips and just nonsensical statements and anger. And I think it would be a lot better for both sides if people just responded meaningfully and with sincere desires, rather than what I see most of the time, which is just people being really angry for no particular reason in general. So I think that would be really good for the dialogue between Christians and atheists, and probably all types of faith as well. But to conclude, I still don't see I see merit in discussing the emotional problem of evil and why people react to certain situations the way they do. I think that's really good. But as far as the logical problem, I think that has been defeated. In the evidential problem, I don't think we have enough data to say one way or another where the evidence truly lies. So to me, it's still a push, but I'd definitely be willing to discuss it more moving forward, because I think it is a topic worth talking about a little bit more. So that's all I have for my closing. So again, I want to thank you guys for moderating and participating, and then the people for listening. So thank you.
Thanks, Rob. All right, Justin, 5 minutes closing.
I won't take all 5 minutes. I don't really actually have anything planned, but I'll just say a few things here. I want to thank you, Thomas, and Rob for having this, for making this happen. And I enjoyed our discussion. I think I got to understand where Rob is coming from a little bit more, and because we've debated in the past, and so that I'm coming to understand Rob and his positions a bit more, which is always valuable. And when it comes to the arguments that I presented this evening, I'm not entirely sure that they've been interacted with in a direct way. So there's been posits, like additional details to theism, to say, okay, maybe this is why posits being things like possible unknowns that we can appeal to. But of course, unknowns can be appealed to on both sides. I can say, just as Rob can say there are possible unknown reasons why God might allow the child to drown in the pool, I can easily come back and say, well, But Rob, there's a bunch of obvious, there's a bunch of, it's obvious that there's a bunch of unknown reasons, additional reasons why God would want to prevent that child from drowning. And so I think that appealing to unknowns in this way, at least in response to the arguments of the type that I brought out today, are largely irrelevant because they cancel each other out. The unknowns on each side cancel each other out, and you're left with the question of what hypothesis better explains the facts on the ground. And I think that, unsurprisingly, I think that in indifference, an atheistic hypothesis is going to do better, and it's going to have more explanatory power in its ability to explain those particular facts than theism, and even more so Christian theism. I think Christian theism has more baggage that makes it more problematic for its explanatory ambitions. That said, I really enjoyed this conversation. So, watch me on Real Atheology.
Hey, I was going to get to that. I want to say, so thanks, Justin. I think maybe it's possible you guys are just too nice. I think I need to get some participants who really hate each other, trying to crawl through the screen and attack more with, that was great. I think that was really respectful dialogue, and I certainly learned a lot. I mean, I already knew all Molinism. I mean, knew it, but no. So I want to thank you guys. Thank you listeners for watching so much. And as I referenced, I was going to say, find Justin Schieber on Real Atheology. Is there anything else you'd like to point people to?
No, not really. That's my main project going on. Reasonable Doubts has wrapped up. So, that's where you'll find most of my content.
And you can find Rob on apologetics105.com and the podcast by that name. Anything you would like to promote, Rob?
I would like to promote reasonablefaith.org, just not as to say that that's an end-all, be-all for Christian thought, and that's what people need to engage in, but just for the other side, for people to examine someone who approaches it from a natural theological perspective, not a presuppositional one. So I think that would be good for people who are looking for atheists, who are looking for arguments from the other side.
Excellent. And of course, if you want to find my stuff, you can go to Atheistically Speaking, the podcast on iTunes. If you want to support more endeavors like this, you can go to patreon.com/atheist, and that'll support more endeavors like this debate, which was great. Thank you guys so much. I'm going to go ahead and call that a wrap. I hope to talk to you again soon, both Justin and Rob. Maybe, Rob, I can get you on the show sometime on another topic or something.
Sure.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. We are out.
Hey, guys.
Take care.
All right, that's it. I do just want to quickly thank, I got two new patrons, and I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. That's Nicole Carmody and Kimberly Hart. Thank you so much for supporting the show. Others, if you'd like to, as I mentioned already, patreon.com/atheist, much appreciated. And that's it. It's an hour episode, so I don't have time to say anything. But next week, going to be very, very good. I liked it a lot. Yeah, that's it. All right. I'll talk to you guys next week.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pair.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.